Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Introducing WonderSuite from Bluehost.com, the tool that makes WordPress wonderful for everyone. Website creation is hard, but now with Bluehost, you can answer a few simple questions about your business and goals, and the WonderSuite tools will automatically lay out your WordPress website or store in minutes. Seriously. From there, you can customize your design, pick your brand colors, and add blocks. No custom theme or coding required. You'll get content suggestions that you can keep or revise. And with Yoast SEO built in, we automatically help you get found in search engines. From step-by-step guidance to suggested plugins to an AI-powered help bot, our built-in tools make WordPress wonderful for everyone. Whether you're a beginner or a pro, you can join over 2 million Bluehost users. Go to bluehost.com/wondersuite. That's bluehost.com/wondersuite.
Hello, listener. Dahlia Lithwick here, host of Amicus, that's Slate's podcast on the courts and the law and democracy and the rule of law. This May, our team will be publishing a special project that we are calling How Originalism Ate the Law. This neutral and academic-sounding methodology of looking at the law is, in fact, anything but neutral. Originalism is to the conservative legal movement what peanut butter is to jelly. As we're going to show you over the course of this project, originalism has been both cover and calling for conservative justices and judges to radically overhaul the lives of millions of Americans. And while they claim to be the apolitical interpreters of the Constitution and its authors' intents, they have overturned Roe, radically expanded gun rights, and eviscerated voting rights. Across Slate.com and the Amicus podcast, we're going to be tackling questions like, where did originalism come from? Why has it taken over? Are progressive originalists really a thing? And am I allowed to have an opinion on originalism? Spoiler, the answer to that last question, you are. To celebrate the launch of this big project, we are running a special 2-week-long free trial of Slate Plus on Apple Podcasts. As a member, you'll get exclusive episodes from How Originalism Ate the Law, plus ad-free listening to all of your favorite Slate podcasts. Join now by clicking Try Free at the top of the Amicus show page or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen.
On Death, Sex, and Money, we feature interviews with you, our community of listeners, getting honest about uncomfortable things.
I developed an illness where it isn't safe for me to drive. A friend once said to me, sex is like air. You don't think about it until you're not getting enough. This is a similar sort of thing if you just replace sex with driving.
Listen to Death, Sex, and Money wherever you get podcasts.
Slate Money is brought to you by Casper, an online retailer of premium mattresses for a fraction of the price. Casper mattresses come with free delivery and returns within a 100-day period. And get $50 towards any mattress purchase by visiting casper.com/slatemoney and using the promo code SLATEMONEY. And by Texture, the mobile app that lets you tap directly into the world's most popular magazines, anywhere, using your phone or tablet. Dive deeper into Vogue, People, Esquire, and Time, and hundreds more with interactive content for a richer reading experience. Right now, try Texture for free at texture.com/slatemoney. And by Carbonite, keep your digital files safe this year. Protect your photos, music, and documents with automatic cloud backup from Carbonite. Try it free without a credit card at carbonite.com. And use the offer code SLATE to get 2 free bonus months if you decide to buy.
Hello! And I'm so happy to be back in the Slate Money Studios after an
absence, it seems like it was very long. Many thanks to Jordan for trying to cobble together some semblance of a show without either me or Kathy last week. Before that, we were trying to cobble together some semblance of a show from atop a Swiss Alp. Now we are back at home.
Yes.
We are cozy with Kathy O'Neill.
Hello, everyone.
The data scientist and blogger at MathBabe.org.
I missed you all, too.
We're here with Jordan Weissman back in his more comfortable second seat position.
Still coming down from my power trip.
I always thought there was a third seat.
you're right, Kathy.
Damn,
it's pretty much a third.
Sorry, man. That was gotta say it like it is.
Jordan Weissman, the third wheel of Slate Money.
So much shade. I literally can no longer see the sun. Oh, I can't see the sun because we're in a recording studio. But so much shade.
So okay. Jordan is going to enlighten us about 92-year-old billionaire, 93-year-old billionaire.
Anyway, I think he's 92.
He's old. He's kind of gaga. His name is Sumner Redstone. He's a fantastically fascinating mogul. We're going to talk about him later. We're also going to talk about, I guess, Bernie Sanders' favorite subject, but a kind of weird angle on it, which is the future of banking and specifically the future of Credit Suisse, which is one of the biggest banks in the world and is kind of not doing very well, if you look at its share price. But first, Kathy O'Neill.
Yes.
It is weird to me, given how, like, obsessed I am about this subject, that we haven't really geeked out about Bitcoin.
I mean,
on
after
this
all,
show.
We're all about money, right? So we should be talking about all kinds of money.
Have we never? I feel like at some point, deep in the Slate Money archives, we have to have geeked out at some point.
You know, but I just want to say we're going to talk about Bitcoin, no question about it. But yeah. We're actually going to talk about a topic which was actually a request from one of our listeners. The Bloomberg editorial board wrote a piece this week called "Bring On the Cashless Future." So we're going to talk about all kinds of digital currencies, including Bitcoin.
So my friend Stefan lives in Sweden, and for over 2 years now has never touched any Swedish cash. His entire life is cashless, and this is not uncommon in Sweden. In certain countries, all transactions are just done with, you know, some kind of card or phone or app or something. So the idea of moving away from cash, it seems kind of crazy in America where we still use, you know, paper checks and stuff, but it's not impossible, and in fact, it has happened to a large degree.
I like how you are going to bash me for paper checks yet again. Yeah, but there are actually really important parts of the economy that rely on paper money.
But not the Swedish economy.
No, the American economy and other economies, including Greek economy. But any place where there's an underground economy, basically. I mean, the thing about Sweden, and I was there recently, never even saw Swedish cash. So I can corroborate that. But the taxi drivers never even told you how much it cost. At least they never told me how much it was cost because it was all arranged beforehand on the computer. So everything is official. It goes through official channels. So we like the idea maybe of not having to carry around cash because it means, for example, that we can't be robbed as easily. But on the other hand, cash actually gives us a lot of advantages and flexibility as a culture.
You mean it's really good for money laundering? Like, if you're doing something illegal, you're like, pay me in cash. If you're like doing something which you don't want to be taxed on, you're like, pay me in cash. If you want to take money out of the country without notifying the authorities, you're probably going to do it in cash. Basically, cash is a great way of doing illegal things. And when Bitcoin first arrived on the scene about 5 years ago or so, everyone was saying, oh, my God, like, you know, Bitcoin, it's the way you do illegal things like buy drugs on the dark web. Basically, you know, if we didn't have cash today and someone tried to invent it, some completely untraceable bearer security, which you could just steal and you could never, you know, get electronically refunded or stuff, the authorities would never allow it.
Right. Well, listen, I want to distinguish between illegal activity and anonymous activity. And it's actually really important when we talk about Bitcoin because, you know, there are differences. So there's somewhere in between, which is like away from the tax authorities type transactions. So when I pay my babysitter in cash and I don't write it down for the tax authorities, it's not illegal. It's just away from the eyes
If you don't give your babysitter a 1099 at the end of the year, that's actually illegal. You do have to do that if you're paying your babysitter more than $600 a year.
Yeah, there are payroll taxes that you've got to also things like
right.
that.
Right. No, I hear you. Yeah. I mean, and you know, sometimes let's just put it this way. I think that most people would agree that that kind of legality is a slightly different from like drug money. And, you know, taking...
Yeah, because nice white women like Kathy O'Neill do one, but not the other.
So exactly.
I agree. I think that there is a... I mean, beyond just, like, how much of the economy actually people want to keep kind of out of the eyes of the government, there is a large libertarian contingent in this country, or there's a libertarian streak in this country, and a lot of people just don't like the idea of someone being able to watch everything they do. I do want to interject one other kind of facet of this conversation about cashless society, which is why econ nerds have been really, really interested in it for the past few years, which is that if you get rid of cash, it actually allows you to do all sorts of crazy monetary policy, or at least makes it easier to do all sorts of crazy monetary policy that people think could help the economy grow faster.
Okay, so let's go there, because the thing about Bitcoin, and I'm glad you brought up the libertarians, one of the things that the libertarians or many of the Bitcoin fans love about it is that it's not centralized, which is to say there is no one single authority that keeps track of everything. Instead, there are various like what are called nodes for Bitcoin that keep track of local transactions and verify them.
Yeah. Bitcoin is sort of one idea of a cashless society, that you have this non-state currency that's just sort of flowing through the whole economy. But then there's another vision of it where essentially, you know, the central bank, the government's in charge, that the Federal Reserve, for instance, would move us to digital currency on its own.
And, you know, there's good reasons to do that, especially if you're the government. You don't have to, like, print paper, which is a waste of money and time, right?
And it really does help in terms of preventing money laundering and tax evasion and things like that.
And then there's this kind of wonkier issue when it comes to monetary policy, and this is why, again, the econ geeks get really excited, especially as one professor named Miles Kimball has been kind of banging the drum about this for years now, which is it solves this problem known as the zero lower bound. And what is that? We've talked about it briefly before, I think, on the show. But to review, it's this idea that when there's a recession, the you know, central bank can only cut interest rates to fight it so far before it hits zero. And that's what happened to the U.S. economy. And there is this idea that you can't cut below zero, because if you give someone negative interest rates, they'll just take all their money and hold it in cash. Because if you give someone a negative interest rate, you're literally telling them to pay you to hold their money. And so if you say you can't have cash, then you can charge people negative interest rates. And that theoretically should kind of stimulate the economy.
I feel like, number one, we already have negative interest rates in Japan and Europe, and they've still have cash, and they've managed to do both. And number two, you know, what we're talking about here is like massive balances of, you know, millions or even billions of dollars, and you can't hold those in cash. And if you do hold those in cash, there is a cost to holding millions of dollars in cash. You know, you need to pay for security guards and stuff like that. So there is, you know, a negative, there is, you know, effective negative interest rate on holding cash as well.
Yeah, I think that's proven to be the case, especially examples in Europe, in Japan, where they've tried negative interest rates. I think what some people, I mean, Kimball wants to see like negative 2%, which is way beyond what most people are trying. So it's, you know, still theoretically kind of interesting. Anyway, this is just one thing out there that people have gotten excited about.
I want to focus on what you just mentioned, and I'm just going to summarize it by saying, digital currencies that are owned by the government, that are controlled by the government, gives the government a lot more control over monetary policy and over data. And I just want to go back to this idea that it doesn't have to be illegal. It could just be anonymous. People want privacy for all sorts of reasons, not just because they're doing illegal activities. Now, when you think about digital currencies owned by governments, China is thinking about doing that.
Right. And now, and this is where Bitcoin comes in, because in the eve of Bitcoin, like when it was young, people believed in this utopian ideal that you could have a stateless currency which was not owned by a government, and that it would be, there would be this sort of mathematical ratification of all transactions, and that we could just trust in math rather than in a government.
Always a scary idea.
And that would work. And what we have seen, especially over the past few months, is that it doesn't work, basically. That Bitcoin has completely failed to scale in the way that it would need to be able to do to be a genuine currency. And the one attempt to try and make it work on a sort of scalable manner, which was this thing called Bitcoin XT, failed miserably. And it is now, I think, most people I know in the Bitcoin world, they've kind of given up on Bitcoin as a currency. And a few of them are still clinging to this idea that this sort of underlying blockchain technology might be useful somewhere, somehow. I'm far from convinced about that. But while Bitcoin was interesting, I think we have seen that, like, a government-less system of money, which isn't run or owned by anyone, that actually doesn't work either.
Yeah, it doesn't look to be working. They're having big fights about how to make it work and be quick. And I just want to take one step to the side and talk about other uses for the technology that Bitcoin has along that comes along with Bitcoin, which is this ledger system. I understand that Blythe Masters is
who, so Blythe Masters. We is a, you know, the fairy godmother of this of this and all financial journalism. She's this amazing woman who, if she didn't exist, you'd have to invent her.
Yes.
But she's most famous for inventing the
credit default swap.
Well, the credit default swap and the synthetic collateralized debt obligation. She's this kind of finance whiz who was extremely senior at JP Morgan, left, and now runs a blockchain company, which seems to be doing okay. They just got a gig in Australia. But, you know, as I say, the jury's still out on that.
So my impression is that Wall Street has gotten really excited about blockchain for, like, really kind of boring reasons. Like,
right.
That essentially that they think of it, it's not like a currency. It's nothing that's going to, like, change the world. It's literally a more efficient way to clear trades, which could be really valuable. Like, it could cut down time to actually execute.
But there is
not.
I used to work at Euromoney magazine, which is a relatively boring magazine. But, like, within the relatively boring world of Euromoney magazine, the one thing which was always the most boring thing you could ever possibly write about was clearing and settlement.
But that's
and
like,
you'd like, and no, but every so often someone would say, "Okay, it's time to do another piece about clearing and settlement," and everyone would, like, run to the corners, okay, and say, "Not me, not me."
But that seems like where Bitcoin's going.
Exactly,
like,
and
exciting.
That is where what blockchain does.
Well, okay, I want to bring it back, and this conversation. So the thing about the blockchain technology that people find sexy is that basically it's incredibly good metadata. You can keep track of everything in a ledger. And it sounds extremely boring. But the ironic thing is if you think about what that means for anonymity, it actually makes it very difficult to make anonymous Bitcoin trades. So
And this is also the other thing that we learned relatively quickly in Bitcoin is that people thought it was anonymous, and it totally isn't. No. There is this blockchain, which is a record of every single Bitcoin transaction in the history of the universe, and it is publicly available to everyone. Yeah. It is the opposite of anonymous.
It is. Well, okay, so finally, my final question is I wanted us to think about what it means for China to have a digital currency that's owned by China, not by Bitcoin. Like, ignore Bitcoin now. Bitcoin failed, and it failed partly because of Chinese hackers, but that's a different story. What possible goal would China have for making this digital currency?
Don't they just want to be Sweden?
I think they just want, well, I want you to pair that with the fact that they've also decided, they've also come up with something called a social credit score. It's just really, I know it's like really apocalyptic, but they want
Kathy Orwell O'Neill.
Seriously, they want data on everything and everyone. That means not just, like, you know, your credit score, but also your reputation, your connections to the party, and now every single transaction you make with anyone.
That's
scary.
That's really scary. I'm not even going to try to add to that. That's just scary. Yeah.
Okay, so on which dystopian note, I am going to start talking about sleep. No, seriously, I one of the things I was doing in Europe was not sleeping because I was very jet-lagged, and in my jet lag state, I went to a few panels about sleep because, you know, Arianna Huffington has a new book about sleep. And I learned a lot about the importance of sleep, including the fact that if you don't sleep enough, you will wind up getting Alzheimer's disease. So people...
Is that true?
Well, I mean, Alzheimer's is linked to many things, but...
This feels like a hard sell.
But buy this mattress.
I also learned if you don't eat well, you'll wind up getting Alzheimer's disease. There's this woman right here in New York, actually, who's doing a whole bunch of work on, like, changing nutrition so that you're less likely to get Alzheimer's. So listen, people, it is very important to sleep well. Get your 8 hours or however much you need and just make sure. Oh, and dream as well.
Wow.
Sleep well and dream well. I genuinely had a dream about Slate Money last night.
That's terrifying. I don't want to know the details.
And a whole bunch of us and like Slate Money listeners wound up going on this crazy adventure and eventually wound up watching the world get destroyed from like some other planet.
Wait a second.
Were we
on a cruise ship?
Were we like Elysium? Were we the people in the city in the sky watching?
Pretty much.
We were like, oh, it's pretty nice up here.
What that says about Felix's self-regard is like I can't even begin to unpack. All right, anyway, keep going.
So you know where I'm going with this, right?
Yes, Casper sleep mattresses.
Casper sleep mattresses. Sleep well, dream well. Get yourself the best mattress that you can because it is totally worth it. However important you think a good night's sleep is, it's even more important. It could even, like, you know, transport you to another planet.
Wow.
Get 50% off your mattress, which is already very cheap because it's, like, disintermediating all those horrible mattress shops and stuff. So what you do is you go to casper.com/slatemoney. And use the promo code SLATEMONEY, and those $500 twin-size mattresses or $950 king-size mattresses become $450 twins and $900 kings, which is so cheap for, like, the best mattress in the world. So casper.com/slatemoney. We are going to move on now to... Jordan, Viacom, CBS.
We're going to sing the ballad of Sumner Redstone, or possibly it's more like an opera, the opera of Sumner Redstone, who is the now former chairman of CBS and Viacom. This is the big executive news of the week. Sumner Redstone is, you know, kind of a legendary media mogul who is now 92 years old. And for a long time, there's been this question about who would succeed him. He has this essentially, you know, both CBS and Viacom are public companies, but they are effectively owned by him and his, you know, family's trust.
He controls 80% of the voting stock, something like that.
Yes, through this other company called National Amusements that is the theater chain his father founded and then he kind of built up, you know, over the, you know, mid-20th century. Anyway, there's been this whole question about succession. What would happen? And he would answer these questions by saying, I'm not going to die. That was literally his answer. He was just like, I'm not, you know, ever going to die.
Maybe 7 or 8 years ago, I went to the Milken Global Conference in Los Angeles, and Sumner gets wheeled out to announce that he's given some vast amount of money to medical research, and basically says in as many words that, like, this is him sort of trying to buy immortality.
It's his moonshot.
Wow.
Yeah, he's one of those.
So is this guy a total narcissist?
He's
very feisty. He's this incredible sort of personality. He fights with everyone. He doesn't talk to his son. He kind of doesn't really talk to his daughter. He tried to give her $1 billion to go away, and she was like, no.
He has what you might call a tempestuous personal life. Essentially, he was married to one woman for about 50 years.
Sound tempestuous.
Had a family. Well, then he left her in 1999. Or she left him, I believe.
What I forget is that was 20 years ago.
Yeah, he also had a series of allegedly had a series of mistresses along the way. There's a famous story about how he burned much of his body while clinging to the window of a Boston hotel room that had been set on fire. And he caught fire. He survived holding on until the truck came and got him. But one of the rumors is that he was with a mistress when that happened. Anyway, so this is like...
Wow.
Anyway, he left his wife in 1999 and kind of became an elderly billionaire bachelor. And just to give you a sense of his business interests, everyone knows CBS, you know, America's Most Not Watched Network, et cetera, et cetera.
So, CBS has got the Super Bowl.
Yeah.
What it is? Yeah. I was just going to be like, what do they have?
And like NCIS.
They don't have Simpsons. I mean...
Yeah. And then Viacom is a media conglomerate. It has MTV, Comedy Central. It has Paramount Pictures. You get the idea.
And Nickelodeon. These companies at one time, like, together?
They were.
They were. And then they split off. And this is one of the most fascinating things, is that Sumner does two things very famously. One is that he pays his CEOs the most lavish kind of pay packages you can possibly imagine. Both the CEOs of Viacom and CBS regularly make $40-50 million a year. It's huge amounts of money. And no one's entirely sure why they make that kind of money, but they do. And, you know, it's what Sumner does. But the other thing which is fascinating is that he has two CEOs. At CBS, he has this guy, Les Moonves, running CBS, who is pretty much the most universally loved and respected CEO in the media business. Everyone knows that he's just incredibly good at his job. He knows his business inside and out. He's been able to keep his network doing really well. He sells ads really well. He looks after his advertisers really well. Everyone just says, oh, yeah, Les, he's, you know, the bee's knees. And, yeah, he gets paid a lot of money, but maybe he probably earns it somehow. On the other hand, Viacom is run by a lawyer, basically.
Philippe Daumen,
who is universally regarded as a complete moron. Well, not moron, but, like, just no good at running a company. Do you remember when the lawyer took over Citigroup, when Chuck Prince was CEO of Citigroup, and it just was a disaster? It's a little bit like that. You have this deal guy who's good at, like, redlining deal documents or something, and he's the CEO of Viacom. He has no vision. He has managed to screw up Viacom. The stock is down like 45% in the past year.
And it's only up 3% in the last 15 or something, right?
It's like he's in charge of a network that thrives on entertaining like young people with MTV, more young people with Comedy Central, and really young children with Nickelodeon, and then a movie studio, which they run on their own logic. And there's no obvious reason why he should be good at any of those if he's not doing deals. So,
And he kind of edges out Tom Preston at MTV, who was the guy who really made like lots of money and then who wound up, you know, basically co-founding Vice, which does know how to do these things. Daumen is kind of useless, but he is incredibly close to Sumner Redstone. He's the one person who hasn't had fights with Sumner Redstone. And so what happens this week, and the reason why we're talking about this all this week, is that Sumner has finally given up his chairmanship of both CBS and Viacom. And the first announcement comes out is CBS. And he says, I'm no longer chairman of CBS. The new chairman of CBS is Les Moonves. And everyone goes, yes, that's wonderful. Les is great. And then everyone's like, well, so are you going to give up your chairmanship of Viacom as well? And who's going to be the new chairman of Viacom? And Shari Redstone, who's Sumner's daughter, comes out in public and says, I don't care who the next chairman of Viacom is. I mean, Shari has the right to be the next chairman, but she decided not to exercise that right. She said, I don't care who it is, just as long as it's not Philippe Daumen.
And then when the board voted, she was the only one who objected.
And it is now Philippe Daumen. It's now the chairman.
So isn't it just bad governance to have the same person as the CEO and the board?
Isn't it bad governance to have a dual class voting right? You know, to have two classes of stock and have all of the voting right in the hands of one man.
So yeah. I want to.
Oh, right. That's the other problem.
I want to come back to the big picture of this, and then I want to talk about more salacious details. But first, the big picture is that I think we talk often about the problems with public companies and like kind of the issues with, you know, whether or not, responding to shareholders on a short-term basis is good for a company or not. CBS and Viacom have like the worst of all possible worlds where they are public companies with shareholders. But then you also have a possibly senile nonagenarian sort of kind of making decisions and having the power consolidated around him and no one being really totally clear what's driving his thinking, or even if he is thinking. The salacious details that play into this is there was literally an article a few months ago titled by William Cohen in Vanity Fair titled Who's Controlling Sumner Redstone? Keep in mind, he at the time was still the chairman of these two very important companies. And basically its theory was that the two younger women in his life, one of whom was a former girlfriend who had then just kind of stayed at his side, and another was his current mistress, had sort of consolidated their control over him. After that article came out, they both were sort of dismissed from his presence. Somehow the lawyers interceded. And then a lawsuit was filed by one of them claiming that he was, in fact, no longer competent, that he had completely deteriorated mentally, that he wasn't fit to watch over himself. She was asking to be his medical caretaker, and that he no longer could talk, but his two desires every day were to have sex and eat steak. That was the two things left in his life. He at 92.
So this guy has got it made, basically.
He literally could not talk anymore, but he wanted to have sex and eat steak, and he was still theoretically in control of these two major companies. So shareholders were a little bit upset.
But I mean, he's not in control if he's... I mean, the CEO is supposed to be in control, right? Isn't that what we discussed?
Well, the chairman who controls all of the voting rights and can hire and fire the CEO is ultimately the person
right.
in control. And the fact that Philippe Domain is now the chairman of Viacom, while also being a member of the trust, which is going to inherit Sumner's stake when he dies, which is never, apparently, according to Sumner, you know, is obviously... he has a huge amount of power now, and what he ends up doing with that power and whether he eventually kind of gives it up and allows the company to be sold for cash, you know, only time will tell. But it's unbelievable how just chaotic and weird this whole thing is. And it is, as I say, just really weird that Domain has managed to consolidate all of this kind of power despite not having any particular visible qualities except for being able to suck up to Sumner.
You know, the good news here is that the good news and bad news is that all this probably means that programming at these, you know, at these networks aren't going to change much. CBS is going to keep doing what it's doing and making money. And that's also bad news because Viacom is in the shit. And, you know, Domain's not going to fix that. So, you know, good, you know, for those who don't like keeping close tabs on, you know, the travails of uber-rich media moguls, you know, not much is going to happen here.
Capitalism.
So, on which note, we're going to move on to mention our other sponsor this week, which is Texture. So,
wait, what is Texture?
So, what is Texture? That's a really good question, Jordan. Texture is, it's this amazing app you can download for your tablet or your phone, which basically gives you a subscription to every conceivable magazine you could ever want to read, and they're all just there on your device, whether it's Men's Health or Men's Fitness or GQ or Esquire or Fortune or The New Yorker or any magazine you conceivably want to read, basically, is going to be right there at your fingertips. And then the cost of this is basically less than if you just bought three magazines at the airport newsstand. It's like all the magazines. And so instead of just buying three magazines at the airport newsstand, you can get, like, all the magazines. And you can get them every month. It's kind of awesome. So, oh, and then also what happens is they'll recommend individual articles because they have an editorial team. They have curated collections for topics. So you can read on single topics across different magazines, which was never really easy before. It's super easy. Stop wasting paper. Stop wasting your money. Get Texture. And it's free. Well, I give you a free trial anyway. If you go to texture.com/slatemoney, you get to try it out for free. So it's kind of obviously worth trying. texture.com/slatemoney, and you'll get your free trial. Okay. Banking.
Yeah, what's going on with Credit Suisse?
Credit Suisse is... I don't know. I feel like Credit Suisse is the wonderful fever dream of Bernie Sanders. Credit Suisse is...
Wow. Okay.
Bernie Sanders has a dream. And the dream is where the banks are just basically forced to get smaller and break up and get out of business lines and not make as much money and not have as much influence and power. And this is exactly the story of Credit Suisse, which used to be one of the greatest, biggest, most important banks in the world, and which now, in the sort of more straitened post-crisis world that we live in, has just decided it's got much more modest ambitions than that and has failed in its modest ambitions.
Yeah, so they're like, their big plan was to go from making money on trading and such things and move over to wealth management in China. Like, that was it. That was the plan. It was literally go find this new billionaire class in the developing world and manage their money.
Well, I just want to throw in, though, that, like, Credit Suisse is doing badly. That's true.
So they lost like, $5.8 billion in one quarter.
Okay, it's doing really badly. Yeah. But I just want to make the point that all banks in Europe are doing poorly. Like, there's an index down 21%
this
year.
Okay. So most European banks are doing badly.
Especially in Italy and Greece.
But the ones which are doing particularly badly are the investment banks. European investment banks have always been a peculiar breed. Investment banking has always weirdly been a sort of thing that the Americans tend to be quite good at and the Europeans tend to be quite bad at.
We're brash and risk-taking and, you know, manifest
destiny
or whatnot.
And so what would happen is that the Europeans would see how much money the Americans were making in investment banking and they would say, we want a piece of that.
Right.
And so they would do what Credit Suisse did, is they would in 2000 was Credit Suisse came in to America and spent $11 billion buying an American investment bank, DLJ, Donaldson, Lufkin, and Jenrette. And that didn't work out so well.
No.
And so $3.8 billion of the $5.8 billion lost this quarter was them writing down that DLJ, DLJ acquisition, because at this point, DLJ is worth nothing to Credit Suisse. And they're like, we have all of this goodwill on our books, and there's no goodwill to DLJ or to investment banking in general. And so they want to move out of investment banking, but they you can't just get out of it overnight. And their investment banking operations are losing money.
So back up a little bit. Why does everyone want to get out of investment banking?
Because it is incredibly, it's much more highly regulated than it used to be. And people are worried about bond market liquidity. And there's a million reasons why it's just not the sexy thing that it used to be.
You're also seeing sort of the effects of higher capital requirements across Europe. One thing actually, all the banks are sort of deleveraging and kind of getting less risky in response to some regulatory requirements.
So DLJ, for example, was a famous bond trading house. And they would have this large inventory of bonds, which they would buy and sell and make lots of money buying and selling. In order to hold that large inventory of bonds nowadays, you need to have a huge amount of capital.
Right.
And Credit Suisse reckons it can put that capital to better use elsewhere. So it doesn't do that anymore.
European regulations are basically forcing the hand.
It's international regulations.
Yeah. Okay.
It's BIS regulations, and it applies to all banks. But because Europeans are just generally worse at investment banking than Americans, like the number of investment banks who are making money is falling, and most of the ones who are making money are American. Credit Suisse, like, never mind the $3.8 billion write-down on DLJ, managed to lose $500 million on investment banking operations in one quarter.
Wow.
On like $1.7 billion in revenue, like, they're not making that much money, and they're losing much more than they're, it's crazy. And the thing is, there's no reason to believe that this won't just continue. Like, sometimes with these big losses, you see, it's a big loss, but that's, some one-off thing. The write-down is one-off, but that still leaves $2 billion of other losses which are not one-off and which are going to just continue.
And is this partly because people know they're trying to pull out and therefore there's a loss of confidence in their ability to get stuff done that they're losing money? Or is it actual decisions they made that are going sour?
I think this is actually a bigger thing, which is that banks like Credit Suisse are too big to manage. And if things are going well, then they kind of just automatically make money. But Credit Suisse has done this astonishing thing. It's decided it wants to move out of investment banking and into wealth management, because wealth management is this kind of much safer thing where you can make money in good years and bad. Credit Suisse is the only time, I've never seen this before, it's kind of amazing, it has somehow contrived to lose money in wealth management.
Well, it decided to do it like at precisely the worst moment. It's like, we're going to go to the developing world where there's all this money, and then like they showed up right when the money disappeared.
This is what I was wondering. Is there like a China effect in wealth management?
They showed up at the party with like a big bottle of champagne when everyone else was going home. And so like it's just not...
So they lost $4 billion in assets under management, which is not a huge amount when you're Credit Suisse. They gained $3 billion in assets under management in Asia. You know, they want to manage trillions of dollars in Asia. Whether and how they're going to get there, no one knows. But here's the crazy thing. The wealth management division in Asia, which is the one thing that they want to grow, they want to shrink absolutely everything except for the wealth management in Asia. That's the bit which they want to grow. The wealth management division in Asia lost $617 million in one quarter.
Now, is that because... I mean, presumably Credit Suisse isn't the only bank that's saying, hey, we're going to go into wealth management. Maybe it's like a crowded field at this point. Everyone's trying to do the same thing in China.
I don't know if that's... Felix, do you have a thought on that?
Lots of people want to do it. I think it's a bit like Uber. Everyone's just like throwing huge amounts of money at China in the hope that something will stick.
And at a poor time... There's one other kind of point about this that I think could be brought back to the U.S. Just kind of coming back to European banks getting boring. Right. There's this whole debate in the U.S. about what do we do about our banks? With Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton, do we kind of regulate them along the margins and try to nudge them in a certain direction towards being boring? Or do you just like come in and try to break them up somehow, whether through legislation or regulatory fiat, which Sanders thinks he can do it through regulators? And I think what we're seeing in Europe is it is possible to make banks boring just by pushing up certain requirements and making them a little bit safer by saying, well, no, you can't leverage up quite as much as you used to. And you don't have to go through these huge kind of regulatory and legislative battles in order to do it.
Hey, that's good news. Let's do this.
So, yeah, so... Hey, American big, you know, J.P. Morgan's and Bank of America's, look at Credit Suisse and it might happen to you next.
I hope it does.
Okay. We have one last sponsor this week, Carbonite, which is where you back up all of your information. Because unless you have automatic cloud backup, basically your entire life could disappear in one hotel fire. You know, take your laptop, with you when you're with your mistress in the Boston hotel room. And next thing you know, your life is, you know, flashing before your eyes. So protect your data from hackers, from viruses, from hotel fires, from, you know, slipping and falling and breaking your hard drive somehow. There's any number of risks. Don't take those risks. Get Carbonite Cloud Backup. And once again, you get a free trial at carbonite.com. There's no credit card required. So use the offer code SLATE and get 2 free bonus months if you decide to buy. That's carbonite.com, offer code SLATE. Protect your life. Okay, finally, numbers.
My number is $144 million, which is how much the taxpayers of St. Louis County in Missouri are on the hook for the continued upkeep on the Rams' old stadium. The former St. Louis Rams are now the Los Angeles Rams NFL team. Felix, you're looking at me like you've no idea. Sorry.
Are they in the Super Bowl?
The football team left the town, but left the stadium behind. Yeah. They still have to pay for the stadium.
Who needs to pay for the stadium?
St. Louis.
Let's take this. So, yes, there's a sport.
There's like mortgage payments?
Yeah, there's this sport called American football. All right. And the teams play it in a large stadium. When the Rams moved to St. Louis, the city and state basically put up public money to finance the whole thing and took out lots of bonds. The Rams have decided to move back to Los Angeles now. So they are, for the 2016 season, going to be the Los Angeles Rams once again. However, the city of St. Louis is stuck with its stadium, which it is still paying down the bonds on and still paying the upkeep, even though it's basically going to be an empty stadium. And this is just one more reason why the economics of sports stadiums is so, so, so bad. We've talked about this on the show before. However, I made this point on Slate this week, is that whenever a consultant shows up with, you know, all sorts of rosy predictions about what a stadium is going to do for your city economically, it never includes the risk that they're going to up and leave and leave you with a giant building that you have to keep paying bonds down on. And this happens. This is not a once off
occurrence. Some lawyer would have been like, there's a contingency in this contract.
But there's no way they would ever agree to that. And because cities are so crazy for sports teams, they just expose themselves to all this risk.
Well, I'm boycotting football, so, I mean,
I'm watching the Super Bowl. I'm going to hate myself for it, but I'm doing it.
All the damage caused by football, and it's been so much good coverage lately about that.
You know, for a while I had a theory that the only moral sport to watch was professional tennis, and then there was this whole match-fixing controversy that cropped up, and so now even that's been ruined for me, so I'm just, anyway.
Okay, I've got a lighter number. I've got a nice number. It's $5.4 billion. That's the national legal sales of marijuana from 2015.
Legal or illegal?
Legal.
Legal.
Yeah. It's up from $4.6 billion in 2014. And we're expecting it to be like $20 billion by, 2020. So we're excited about this new industry. It's a real industry.
Was that the Royal Wee? Was that
a multi-billion-dollar?
I looked at the price of weed website again because I was like, "How much does it cost in my neighborhood?" And they have these handy. Did you know that they have these handy little things about how enforced are the laws against smoking weed and how socially acceptable
How
socially acceptable is smoking weed on the Upper West Side of New York?
It's somewhere in the middle. It says
really.
Okay.
I think it's pretty accepted.
My number is 3.9%, which I just discovered this week, but this is a number which has been around for a little while. This is the latest number we have for the percentage of publicly listed U.S. equities in the Yale Endowment. So if you remember when we had Harold Pollack on this show with his index card saying, you know what you do with your money? You are not some crazy hedge fund endowment manager. So you just put your money in the stock market in an index fund and don't do anything with it. The Yale endowment is a crazy like hedge fund endowment. And they have decided that they're just putting all of their money in private equity, in venture capital, in hedge funds, even in foreign stocks. But in terms of just buying U.S. stocks, which is what most of us put, like, most of our money in, 3.9%.
You know, the thing about these endowment funds, as crazy as they are, they do pretty well. This is actually one of the little-known parts of capital in the 21st century. But Piketty was trying to figure out whether or not the rich are different than you of me when it comes to, like, their investment returns. Like, do they make more money than the rest of us? And one of his experiments was just, like, looking at college endowments and philanthropic endowments. And, like, he concluded, like, yeah, it looks like they do better from what we can tell.
You know, a lot of people I've talked to recently have described the modern American university.
As a hedge fund with a little educational institution attached?
Yes, exactly. I want to have that as a topic.
I've written about it. You've written about it.
I specifically want to ask the question, why are they getting tax-free status?
I have there's an entire article on Slate.com about like 2,500 words on that.
There are so many articles about this. But we will return to this even on the podcast. You don't need to read things on the internet. We can talk to you about it.
Okay.
Who would read?
Felix Post-Text Salmon is telling you not to.
We will come to the economics of tax deductibility, nonprofit status, university endowments, and so on and so forth in a forthcoming episode of Slate Money. But that, as far as this episode of Slate Money, is sadly all we have time for. So thank you for listening. Thank you to the amazing Audrey Quinn, back in the saddle, producing us professionally and amazingly. Thank you to Steve Lichtai, who executive produced the Slate podcast. Somehow we have two executive producers. There's also Andy Bowers. I'm not quite sure what the difference between the two of them is. The entire roster of Panoply podcasts can, in any case, be found at itunes.com/Panoply. So next week we'll be back. Oh, with a special guest.
Yes.
Yes. We're going to have a genuine member of the international global elite with us next week.
Yeah, like certified. Like I'm pretty sure he has like a tattoo somewhere. That
didn't
says,
he also
like,
used to run the Harvard Endowment?
And he used to run the Harvard Endowment. So
well,
maybe
we can ask him
about that.
Yeah, that's like not even like the top like five of his like credentials.
Well, I remember that about it.
So
we're not going to say who though.
Tune in next week with an elite money manager type. It's going to be a fascinating conversation. We'll talk to you then.